Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Aliza Licht, and I am super excited to be joined today with my friends Laura Gassner-Otting and Christina Wallace. We know each other previous to this event, and we all had books come out in April. So we thought, why not do something together? Because all of our books are actually very symbiotic and really support each other's mentality in terms of success and leadership and what that means. So my book is On Brand, and I am the founder of Leave Your Mark, which is a brand consultancy and multimedia constituency of books, podcasts, community, etc. And I'm really excited to be with you all today. And I'm going to pass it over to Laura.
Yeah. So my name is Laura Gassner-Otting. Mm-hmm. I am the author of the brand new Wall Street Journal bestselling book, Wonder Hell, Why Success Doesn't Feel Like It Should and What to Do About It. And I am super excited to be here today because I was having a conversation with Aliza and realized that if we all have things coming out at the same time, all the boats can rise. And because all of our books are symbiotic, as she said, it's actually a great opportunity for us to bring not just like three separate webinars to each of you, but to actually be able to do it in a way where it's kind of a continuum. So that's what we're going to do today, is have a little bit of that continuum. And now I'll pass it over to Christine.
Wait, first I need to know, Laura, do you have an animated book cover image?
I do.
Is that what you get when you make the Wall Street Journal bestseller list?
Like, no, that's what you get.
My team is dropping the ball.
That's what you get when you decide that your word for 2023 is elevation. And I was like, if I want to elevate everything I've done before, what does elevation look like? And Ozan Verrill sent me his book cover, and it has this rainbow on. The rainbows were sort of like shooting through sky. And I sent it to my publisher, and I was like, okay, where do I get one of those? And he's like, well, that's really interesting. I'm like, let's elevate it. So like my challenge to everybody, even just starting off today, is to, as you're thinking about the concepts that we're going to talk about, is how do you think, what do I have in my life? And how do I take these concepts to elevate everything I'm already doing and just make it just 1% better?
Oh, I have a new question now for us once we get started based
okay.
on what you're amazing. Christina, take it away.
Well, I'll do this quick. I'm Christina Wallace. I'm a senior lecturer at Harvard Business School, where I teach entrepreneurship and marketing. My new book, The Portfolio Life, How to Future-Proof Your Career, Avoid Burnout, and Build a Life Bigger Than Your Business Card. Absolutely thrilled to be with these fantastic authors. Now I'm going to go put out a request for an animated GIF of my cover. I don't know what I'm going to animate, though. I might just be like the Post-it notes, like fluttering in the breeze.
Oh, yes. In the breeze. Yes. Very good.
We like it.
Amazing. Amazing. So, yeah. So we're so excited to talk with you all today. And we wanted to start off actually with asking everyone here to put into the chat publicly, what do you hope to get out of this event? We want to really steer this ship toward you all. We could talk for hours all day together. We do. I mean, both Laura and Christina have been on the Leave Your Mark podcast. You can listen to their episodes as well. But we really want to make this as beneficial as possible. So if you have a quick thought for something that you are dying to hear, please put it in the chat. Thank you.
And I would even say, if you saw the announcement for this and you were like, oh, that's cool, was there something in particular that you were like, this is what I want to learn. This is what I'd like to know a little bit more about. This is a challenge that I think that I can get on the other side of. And I think when we put this together, we sort of realized that all of our books were a little bit about how do we define success on our own terms, right? Whether it's being on brand with who you are, whether it's creating a portfolio life that's more than your business card, or whether it's as you're finding your way into that success and you're starting to feel something that is exciting because maybe you're realizing that there's more to you than you thought. And it's also kind of stressful. I would love to know from people in the chat, and I'm also going to throw this question out to Christina first, and then we can move our way through. When did you realize that your definition of success wasn't the same as everybody else around you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm probably the only person in the history of the world whose parents really wanted her to be a professional musician. So I studied classical piano my entire childhood. I added cello and voice halfway through, and I ended up going to a boarding school for the performing arts where almost all of my classmates went to conservatories and then became professional musicians and actors and artists and writers. And I got to senior year and said, I don't want to go to Juilliard. I don't want to be a concert pianist. I want to go to college and I want to double major and study other things. And I don't know where that will go. It's a very undefined path as opposed to a very linear path as a professional musician. But I knew I needed to do something that was
the exact same.
Charlene, could you
mute real quick? I'm just going to mute people while you talk. Keep going. Perfect. This is an amazing story.
I knew I needed to do what was right for me. And so I broke everyone's hearts and went to college.
Well, that's hilarious because my story is exactly the opposite, where I dropped out of law school and broke everyone's hearts because I had always been told that I should be a lawyer. I had a fourth grade teacher who told me that I was really argumentative and I should become a lawyer. And I was like, well, you're wrong because, you know, I'm argumentative. But then I proceeded to create a path that got me to law school, where on the very first day I looked around and I was like, I don't want to be here. I made a huge mistake. This is not the right place for me. And so I did what a lot of us women do when we're in terrible situations, is I dated the world's worst boyfriend. And I joke around that the world's worst boyfriend had precisely two, like, exquisite taste in two things. One, girlfriends, obviously, but the other being unknown presidential hopefuls from tiny southern states. And one day he's like, I want to stop this guy's campaign office. He's running for president. And I was like, governor who? From where? Arkansas? Not a chance in hell. But then I heard this man, this governor from Arkansas, talk about this idea of compulsory community service, like community service in exchange for college tuition. I was like, yes, that has to happen. And so I dropped out and I joined that campaign. And much to the chagrin of everyone in my family, I ended up in the White House. So, you know, kind of the opposite of you, but still, like, that moment where you're like, my definition is not the same as everyone else's, but in order for me to be me, I got to be on brand, right?
The use of on brand. Similar to you all, I think the parental definition of what is success, I think, affects a lot of people, especially depending on where your parents are from. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, culture has a big part to do with it. I grew up loving fashion. Fashion was not a job, according to everyone that I surrounded myself with. Being a doctor was a job. So I went to school and I studied neurobiology and physiology, and I was pre-med and I was going to be a plastic surgeon, and I did all the things, MCAT, internship, all of it, until I decided, actually, I want to work at a fashion magazine. So much to my parents' chagrin also, I was like, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. I don't want to wear masks all day. That's like actually what I said. And that worked out super well.
It tracks because you love a red lip. Like, you can't wear masks and red lipstick, as we all have found out.
It's literally impossible. But I will say that I think what we're all three talking about is that gut intuitive feeling, that whatever path you're on is not the correct one. And there's a lot of pressure externally to sort of show up as the person other people want you to be. But we all three decided to go with our gut and do the thing that we knew we really wanted to do. So yay for us.
So yay for us indeed. And so the way that we're going to organize today is that I'm going to introduce our first sort of teacher, if you will, and she is going to coach one of our other teachers, if you will. And we're sort of going to kind of do a little bit of a round robin. So our first has written the amazing book, Leave Your Mark, which has a beautiful book cover with a red lip on it. An absolute expert in marketing, in speaking and podcasting, personal branding, and the founder of Leave Your Mark. She is a multimedia brand and consultancy expert. She advises businesses, mentors individuals on brand building and career development. And she has 2 decades of experience in marketing, communications, digital strategy in the fashion industry. She was with DKNY. She was a PR girl. She was an award-winning personality and pioneer fashion influencer with over 1.5 million fans worldwide. And her reveal generated 230 million media impressions. So this is a woman who knows how to teach us all how to leave our mark. Now, Eliza, I am so excited about this because when you and I first spoke, I think I told you the story of when I first learned how to be a speaker. And when I first learned how to be a speaker, I would get up on stage and I would sort of talk like a TED talker because this is how we do it. And this is how women should be on stage. And then I got some coaching from somebody who was a little bit misogynistic and saying, "You're funny. You should be funny. Women aren't usually funny." And I was like, well, that's funny, right? But I started giving a talk and about a minute into the talk, he was like, "Well, stop. What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm giving the talk." And he goes, "Never do that again. How would you tell the story at a cocktail party?" And I was like, "Oh, well, I would tell it like this." And he was like, "Do that." And just learning how to be me and embracing the fullest version of myself, I think was incredibly liberating, and not just liberating, actually made me become much more successful on stage. So I'm really excited to get into this next piece. So what do you have to tell us about how we can be on brand?
Well, first of all, I love that you remembered Leave Your Mark, because I hate to say that my firstborn is now like my stepchild, but a little bit, my firstborn book is like, okay, you're good. You're over there, whatever, you're now a podcast, you're fine. So this book is very intentionally, the subtitles are really important. Shape your narrative, share your vision, shift their perception. Because the idea of waiting around for people to notice that you're good at what you do is not a strategy. And Christina, I'm proud to say that the cover of Harvard Business Review literally says this month, how to build your personal brand, how to make sure people know your value. Mm-hmm. And as a former publicist in fashion, I will tell you, I spent a lot of my years thinking about headlines, right? What is the hook? What do we want people to know? So if you think in terms of yourself, what is that headline you want people to know about you? And have you done the work to shape it so that people are actually speaking about you and what you do in a way that is complimentary and in a way that really represents how you want to be known? Because to me, the whole purpose of this book on personal branding is to align your self-reflection with public perception. Mm-hmm. And a strong personal brand means your name is dropped in rooms you're not in, and you're recommended for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So that is the purpose of on brand. And that's how you can be on brand, by actually doing that work. And hopefully I've made it easy for you in on brand.
Wait, can you say those 2 things again?
Which part?
It is the last thing. It is having your name spoken in rooms where you're not. Like, what? Okay, give us the definition again. Because that was really good. And I think we got to write that down. That was really good.
So to me, the definition of a strong personal brand is when your name is dropped in rooms you're not in, and other people recommend you for opportunities that people haven't even heard of yet. Mm-hmm. And the only way that can happen is if you've done the work to shape your own narrative and position yourself as to what you want to be known for. So people can be like, "Oh my God, you need someone. Oh my God. Do you know Christina Wallace? She'd be perfect for that." Right. Yeah. So it's not, a lot of people confuse personal branding. They think, "Oh wait, no, that's not for me. I'm not interested. I'm not on social media. I don't want to be an influencer. That's not me." But I really double down in on brand, balancing between, okay, if you do want to be very active online and what that means, but also how you're showing up in real life, because how we build those authentic relationships and how you earn social capital and how you have executive presence and how you do, you know, go on stage or turn on a Zoom and speak like the way Laura does, like that is all part of personal branding too. It's not just an Instagram post.
I love this so much, Aliza, because when we got a chance to chat on your podcast, it became so clear, like, this is why your book and my book dovetail beautifully, because when you do multiple things, as I do, when you have a portfolio, as we will talk about in a little bit, it can sometimes feel really overwhelming to you and to everyone else of like, okay, well, what exactly is your one liner? What are you known for? What do you want to be known for next? What's that season of life, especially if you've made a big pivot? Giving your friends, your network, that one-liner, that elevator pitch is what arms them with getting your name into rooms you're not in. If they want to help you, but they don't know how to talk about what you're up to, they're going to feel paralyzed by this. And I think this is so important because, as you know, we've all seen this research that says it's not your network, but your network's network, that second degree mm-hmm. connection that is the most powerful in getting opportunities. So by definition, these are people who don't know you. And the only way you're going to get those opportunities is if the intermediaries, the people who love you and want to help, know exactly how to put you up for those opportunities.
But to your point of the portfolio life, I think it's simple to say, like, boil it down to a one-liner. And we've all grown up knowing, like, the elevator pitch mentality. It's like, by the way, you need to be able to say it within the course of an elevator ride. That's why it's called an elevator pitch. But I also think there's something to be said of, like, owning the multi-hyphenate, right? Mm-hmm. And saying, like, you know what? I actually am many things. And mm-hmm. in this particular room right this second at this industry conference or wherever I am right now, this is the pitch. This is the Absolutely. Introduction that's tailored to this audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this is a big part of it. I mean, you'll hear later on, I literally introduce myself as, like, I am a human Venn diagram who's yeah. built a career at the intersection of business, technology, and the arts. I own that multi-hyphenate, that interdisciplinary space from the get-go. And I do that rather than say, here's my current job title, because my current job title might not be relevant to the conversation we're having. And so instead, I really care that you understand where I sit, that strategic intersection, and crucially, the interdisciplinarity is what I bring to the table. That is my brand. And related to that, it's not just, as you mentioned, it's not just the one-liner, it's the breadcrumbs that you leave that support that. It's the article that you might write or the podcast you go on or the things that you put online or the things that you don't put online, as you recently had a great little chat on LinkedIn about, right? Who you follow, who you don't follow, all of this supports who you are in the world. And leaving those breadcrumbs allows your people to find you, which is yeah. what I think is so strong about your model. I love it. Also because you use Venn diagrams.
That's true. And yes, I mean, a Venn diagram goes a long way, but I think what we're all talking about here is, you know, building equity in your name, and you both do it so well as just, like, other examples of people. And again, none of us are Kim Kardashian, right? Like, we do not have 300 million followers, right? So when you think about, I'm going to just call us normal people, right? Who have been able to shape their narrative and understand how they're showing up and building equity in their name, which, by the way, I had to rebrand from a corporate employee, right? I leaned on the name of Donna Karen and DKNY for 17 years. That was my identity. Mm-hmm. So how do you actually reshape that? And I think what we're seeing online right now, especially on LinkedIn, is there's a shift in the headline of LinkedIn where people are actually putting in there how they identify from a skill set and experience perspective versus here's my title at this company, mm-hmm. which I think is a great thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
Laura, you're on mute. Laura, you're on mute.
Sorry. I was muting because the puppy was making some sounds. So we have a question from Ruth Sternberg that I want to throw in here. She says, as a career coach, I find that people can't get to this first step. First, get to the core of what your extra value is. You can't shape anything until you know what the narrative actually is. So, Aliza, when you're working with people to figure out their brand and to figure out how to shape that narrative, it sounds great to say, like, I sit at the you know, the intersection of this and this, if you know who you are, right, as Christina's done so well. But what about the rest of us who don't quite know even how to start? Like, it's hard to capture, you know, the resume. How do we figure out, like, where, what's a good exercise to start if we're just getting
exactly going? Exactly what Christina put in her book and what I put in my book, for different reasons, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. So the Venn diagram actually allows you to think in terms of multiple buckets at the same time, right? So what is my work? What am I passionate about? What do I want to align with? What do I actually want to talk about? I think of it in terms of content strategy. Like, how do you connect the dots between all the things you do and love and want to talk about? What are the things that you want to leave out just for private consumption? And thinking about how that rolls up to be kind of what you want to be known for. Christina does it from the perspective of really understanding how to map your experience. And from a professional level, right? I mean, Christina, you can say it better than me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's as much about what do you bring to the table as what are you curious about learning more about, right? Like, as Aliza pointed out, like, you can make these pivots and you can say, I want to talk more about this. I might not be an expert yet, but I'm going to include that as part of who I am and where I'm going as I make these pivots. But the other thing for me, self-reflection is obviously where I start. But if you are feeling lost, if you're like, I don't know what I bring to the table. Like, I've done this one corporate thing for 30 years. Like, I do X. My next advice is to go and talk to the people who know you and love you and let them tell you what they see. And any individual person's feedback, like, don't put too much weight in it. But the body of conversations, as you start collecting more data points, that's where you start really getting the insights. And I boil this down to three questions that I've done this myself. And I found it really helpful. Number one, when have you seen me happiest? I think that's often an opportunity to pull out things that you might not recognize are important to you or really playing to your strengths. When have you seen me happiest? Number two, what do you come to me for? Like, what's that spark in your head? You're like, you know, I should see what Aliza thinks about this. And then where do I stand out against my peers? What's that thing that maybe I think is really easy and I have no idea that this is a superpower, but you're like, you're a geek who can speak. Like, that's amazing, right? So so those are like just really starting points for a conversation where people can reflect back to you what they see. And that might be a really helpful place to go as well.
I love that. And I remember you telling me that after you had your 70 coffees in 30 days, when you were trying to sort of refocus yourself.
Yes.
In On Brand, I have mental gymnastics exercises throughout the book. So there's actually workbook pages in the hardcover. And part of that is actually making a Google form where you do this personal branding self-assessment and you send it out to your trusted colleagues, your friends. You do it. You can do it anonymously. You can do it for actual direct feedback. But there's a series of questions that you answer for yourself privately. And then you ask the same questions to your network of trusted peers. And then you see where the overlap is or isn't. So an example of my first question is, three adjectives that your colleagues would use to describe you professionally, or what would your colleagues say is your superpower? Hmm. You might think it's one thing, but they may see something totally different. And that is where we have to sort of connect the dots.
Laura, I want to take this this jump over to your book, because I feel like wonder hell is like the most perfect word I have ever heard to crystallize this idea that, like, you get exactly what you want, you get this level of success, and then, oh, holy crap, right? So I want to do just a very quick read through of like details that people need to know about you. And then I want to hear more about some of the key ideas here, because this is so interesting. So Laura is an author, a catalyst, an executive coach. I love that, catalyst. Entrepreneur, has this edge, 25 years going from the law school dropout to being in the White House, shaping AmeriCorps, to being a VP at a search firm, to starting her own search firm, all the way through. Now you probably recognize her from her appearances on Good Morning America and Today. I'll be studying those so that I'm prepared when it's my turn. Just has, like, she's done it all. She's written three best-selling books. She's done TED Talks. She's all across the spectrum. And I love this idea, this quote you have on your website. It says, if all we get in life is what we deserve, we would never get what we demand. So I have to hear how did we get to this crystallization so clearly of Wonder Hell? And what do our audience need to know about this today? Because this is, I mean, yeah. Fantastic.
It's funny. I've actually never connected the code on my website to Wonder Hell before. And it that actually is part of the crystallization, because there were so many people who, like, along my career, if I've gone like on a nice vacation or something, they'll be like, oh, you should go. You deserve that. And it's like, no, I don't deserve it. I worked my ass off for it, right? I demanded it. I demanded it of myself. I demanded it of my boss to give me the raise so I could afford it, because I was, you know, fresh in the work and I was, you know, not getting paid as much as the other people next to me, right? Like, I think a lot of times we feel like if we just, like, work hard and we put our, you know, shoulder to the wheel and our nose to the grindstone, like, we'll get everything we deserve. And, you know, along the way, we start succeeding. We work really hard. And whether we sell our first business or we sell our first tube of lipstick or our first consulting contract, like, whatever the thing might be, it might be this huge victory, it might be this small thing. We see this version of ourselves where we're like, oh, I didn't know I could do that. What else can I do? Right? We're not getting what we deserve. We're getting what we're demanding, what we're working hard for. So when my last book, Limitless, came out, I had written that book, frankly, because I had done a TEDx kind of by accident. I wasn't planning on doing it. And I got asked to do one mostly because I had a crisis of identity where I didn't know what my brand was when I was no longer LGO, CEO. I'm the you know, the head of a company that I had sold. And so I started blogging about a whole bunch of stuff that was making me crazy in the world. And I got asked to do a TEDx on it. And that TEDx got some attention. And I got offered to go fly to Boise, Idaho for $1,500. And little did I know at the time, I was going to get a hat with the potato on it. Cause, you know, Boise and Boise's on brand, by the way. So I had just spent 20 years in the deliverables business, right? Finishing a 4-month project, giving them a 3-inch binder of, you know, all the reports. And I went and I spoke for 45 minutes and they handed me a check. And I was like, tell me more about this job. Like, this is really interesting. I need to know. And then as I got offered more and more places to speak, I started noticing that all the people that were making quote unquote real money all had books. So I was like, I better get me one of them. So I wrote Limitless based on 20 years of work in the executive search world, where I realized that the definition of success that was handed to us by other people along the way is never actually ours. Like, we can't be insatiably hungry for somebody else's goals. So what actually matters to us? How do we find them? And I literally, Christina, thought three people would buy that book, like my mother, my father, and maybe my sister used for my mother, but it was successful. And in that moment of it launching at number 2 on the Washington Post bestseller list, I was like, number 2? How do I get to be number 1? And what about the Wall Street Journalist? And what about the New York Times? And someone got to sit under the oak tree with Oprah. Why not me? It got to be someone, right? And because I was in that moment where I was so completely exhausted from the book launch that the part of my brain that governs my humility was just gone. So this voice inside my head was like, you can be bigger. It can be more. Go. And everybody around us says, if you can name it, you can tame it. And I was like, I don't want to tame it. I want to claim it. Like, I want to demand everything that's there for me, everything that's possible. And so I realized in this moment when I was on this airplane flying back from this red eye flight from Vancouver, I was like, I'm not in, you know, the center seat and coach with like a guy snoring on one side of me and a guy snoring on the other. I'm in Wonder Hell. Like, I'm in the space between who I was yesterday and who I just realized I can become tomorrow. And it was in that moment that I had to figure out, well, who do I really want to be? Because it's amazing. It's exciting. It's humbling, but it's also stressful and anxiety provoking and imposter syndrome filling and identity questioning, right? I had all of these uncertain feelings. And what I realized was that those feelings we think are limitations that stop us from the thing we want to do, that voice inside of our head going, I don't know, you haven't done this before. When really they're invitations saying, oh, I don't know, you haven't done this before. And so I needed to learn how to get from here to there. So what I want to know from you, Christina, is was there a moment in your life where you were like, I thought I could only do this, but now I realize, because I did all this work and it opened these doors, that I'm like, actually, there's even more doors behind these. And I didn't know those were available to me. Have you had a moment like that in your career?
Yeah. I mean, entrepreneurship had never even crossed my list of things that were available to me. I come from a working class family in Michigan. My grandpa built cars on an assembly line. My mom was a secretary. And, by the time I came to Harvard Business School to do my MBA, the plan was like, I'm going to build a life in the nonprofit performing arts. And then the whole economy collapsed on my third week of business school, and that wasn't an option. And so I said, well, I guess I have to get like a corporate job or something. And it was while I was here that entrepreneurship just sort of started to be a thing. We have a startup tribe and it started blossoming. And it was the first time that I recognized that, like, oh, creating artistic things and creating companies are actually a very similar skill set. Kind of have to have this idea and a little bit of a reality distortion curve, and you got to get people behind you and, you know, build something by the time the curtain goes up on like some shoestring and some duct tape. And I thought for a hot second, like, well, who am I to build a company? Like, who am I to go raise venture capital money? Like, I haven't seen this much money in my entire life, and I'm just going to ask a stranger for it to go build this thing.
How'd you get past that? Because like, I can see the comparison, the analogy to music, right? Because it's, you're creating melody and lyric at a whole cloth. Like, I can totally see that, like being comfortable with improvisation. Mm-hmm. But how do you get past the imposter syndrome? That's like, you're just a musician. Like, what do you think? Like, your grandpa's on the assembly line. Like, who the hell are you to be able to believe that you can do this?
So two things. One was by seeing a whole bunch of other people that I didn't think were any better than me go and try.
And some of them may be a little worse, right?
I didn't think I was necessarily smarter than them, but I was like, well, if they can do it, like, I mean, I could probably do it. And then being around, I mean, there are many good things and there are some bad things about being in places of such wealth and privilege, like Harvard Business School. But certainly one of them, as someone who did not grow up around money, it helped me normalize sort of the scale of investment and capital that's required to build businesses, that numbers that start with, you know, million rather than thousands, like, that's not an obscene thing to ask for if what your goal is to build a company. And I think part of this is I needed to see examples and see that normalization of like, this is absolutely expected that you need resources to build that vision. And people that aren't any smarter than you are doing it. So maybe you can too.
And I just have to say that most people don't realize there aren't that many new ideas in the world.
Yeah.
It's how you package it, truly. Mm-hmm. And when you're pitching yourself to anyone, they're investing in you as the founder and the front person, right? So the ability to show up and to tell a compelling story as to your why or the problem you're trying to solve, that all has to do with what you want to be known for when you actually show up and ask for that money, because plenty of people have an idea, right?
Yes, it's all in the execution. And I think a big part of that is also the belief that you are the person to do that, right? And it's that, I say this all the time to my students, the story you tell yourself about yourself is the most limiting or the most powerful thing that is going to enable you to do what you want to do. If you tell yourself, I'm not that kind of person, I don't have permission to do that. That's not what I'm able to do. Then you won't even try. But if you say, I am, I'm literally the person to build this company. I've never built a company before, but you know what? So have a lot of other people, and they figured it out. So I'm going to go and do this. And you show up with that narrative, then everyone else will believe you, or at least some people will.
Yeah. And, you know, for anybody who's on this call with us, who's like, I don't know, that sounds intimidating. I'm an introvert. I'm not so sure I can do it. I am a raging introvert. So like, I see you, you know, like not in person, because that's uncomfortable because I'm an introvert, but I see you, I can feel you. So there's actually science behind making your own luck. Like how do people are born lucky or unlucky. Like how do you become lucky? You become lucky by being the kind of person who says yes to things, who goes to events, who tries new things, who, when you see failure, you realize that failure is not finale, it's fulcrum. Like you change the narrative to this is just a learning opportunity. They hear things like you're not good at this, but they hear it as I'm not good at it yet. Everything that got us to here isn't going to get us to there, but everything that got us to here happened on a platform of learning how to learn, learning how to create a network, learning how to get better at something over and over and over again. So that skill set, even if it's not directly transferable, will be translatable. So everything that got you to here will get you to there in a different way than you expect, but it's just not that you're not good. You're just not good yet. And here's the thing about the science for us introverts is that we don't have to act like super confident extroverts. We can be situational extroverts when it's needed and then kind of go back to our cocoon afterwards. Like I can get out on stage in front of 5,000 people. Then I go back to my room and I order room service and I curl up in a ball and I don't even watch Netflix because it's like too much interaction. So I think we have to, you know, when you're looking at other people and saying, well, if they can do it, well, I can't do it because I can't act like them. You can act like them situationally. So it's figuring out how do you do it in a way that works for you as much as you need to do it so that it works for you.
Yeah.
I love that. And actually, someone put in the chat about belief system being a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the mental gymnastics exercises in On Brand is actually, what is your belief system? And how do you, you know, there's this one question that's phrased first negatively, then rephrased neutrally, and then rephrased positively, because we are putting our own tonality on things. And with regard to like, oh, I'm not good enough, or oh, that I don't deserve that. It's like, I think a lot of people waste time wondering how they got into the room instead of realizing that if you're in the room, you belong there. And now the question becomes, what are you going to do now that you're in the room? What impression are you going to leave?
Absolutely.
By the way, 70% of people experience imposter syndrome. So the odds of you feeling like you don't belong in the room are high, but the odds of you being the only person who feels that way are super low. So there's this thing called I forgot what it's called. I just blanked on it. It's an idea where if I don't feel like I belong, I am going to puff up my chest and act like I'm confident. And if you see me, you're like, well, if Laura feels like Laura looks super confident, I better puff up my chest and act like I'm super confident too. And then I see you and I'm like, well, if Christina or Aliza is super confident, well, I better be super confident so they don't think that I don't know what I'm doing, right? And all of a sudden, both of us, all three of us, all 10 of us, whoever's in the room, we don't get that opportunity to say, you know, I actually don't know what I'm doing here, and then figure it out together. So we end up faking it, but we never actually make it because we're building this, you know, sort of house of cards where it doesn't actually work. So we want to talk about the portfolio life. Mm. Before we do that, I want to tell people that if you're interested in WonderHell and you're sort of wondering where in WonderHell you are, you can go take a 15-question quiz at wonderhellquiz.com. The book is built a little bit around an amusement park where there's three towns: Imposter Town, Doubtsville, and Burnout City. So where in WonderHell are you? You can figure that out at wonderhellquiz.com. Aliza, do you have a place for people to go to figure out some of the exercises or get some downloads?
I have a reading companion on alizalick.com that is for book clubs primarily, but also individual readers, but it'll help you think through things. So that's on alizalick.com too. But before we switch to Christina really quickly, Laura, you said something to me on the episode of Leave Your Mark that I think is so, says it all. And you were talking about the feeling of excitement versus fear. Will you just share that one thing really quickly of how they're like the same?
Sure. So when, say, public speaking, for example, people say that their number one fear is public speaking. The number two fear, death. Okay. Number one fear, public speaking. Number two fear, death. Number three fear, getting bitten by a snake. Okay. You're going to survive speaking in public. You're probably going to survive getting bitten by a snake. You are definitely not going to survive getting dead. So we all are so scared of speaking in public, but if you're standing backstage and you have to speak, what happens? Your heart rate starts, you know, going really fast. It's palpitating. Your stomach starts fluttering. Your knees start feeling weak. You start sweating from all the wrong places. But when you're really excited, what happens? Your heart rate gets going, your stomach starts fluttering, your knees start shaking, maybe you start sweating from all the wrong places. It feels exactly the same. Those two feelings manifest in your body exactly the same way. What you tell yourself about it is different. So when I'm backstage, I know that I don't have to go out and be confident for 60 minutes. I just have to be confident for 60 seconds. And once I'm confident for 60 seconds, then my body, if I go out and I'm like, hello, Cleveland, the people who I'm speaking to roar back and suddenly I feel confident because I've turned that nervousness into excitement. So if we just tell ourselves that I'm actually, what a great opportunity this is, I'm excited to be here, even though it feels so dumb, like you're just changing what you're saying in your head, it actually changes the narrative and it changes how your body interprets the manifestation of those physical reactions in your body.
I love that. I'm so glad. I'm so glad you share that because it's so true. Okay, moving over to Portfolio Life. Miss Christina Wallace, so serial entrepreneur, author, Harvard Business School professor, you believe that pouring yourself into a single full-time job right this second is the riskiest move you can make. Very strong words. Mm-hmm. Your new book is The Portfolio Life, How to Future-Proof Your Career, Avoid Burnout, and Build a Life Bigger Than Your Business Card. Such a great title. We've already shared that you're a human Venn diagram, mm-hmm. but I want to share the three principles about the anti-hustle, pro-rest approach to work-life balance that your book actually delivers in three tenets. One, you are more than any one role or opportunity. Two, diversification will help you navigate change and mitigate uncertainty. And three, when, parentheses, not if, your needs change, you can and should rebalance. Mm-hmm. Christina, you wrote this book for yourself. Tell everyone why you wrote it. She doesn't need to sell any copies, everyone. It's just for her. No, I'm kidding. You should buy her book.
No, I literally wrote this book for myself because after I left my life as a concert pianist, I studied math and theater and did minors in physics, political science, and music, and then started a career in the opera world before joining, going to business school and becoming an entrepreneur. Like, I've literally done all these different things. And everyone around me, my mother included, happy Mother's Day, was like, what are you doing? Like, is there a strategy here? Or are you the world's smartest flake? And so part of this was writing down the model, the framework for how I was thinking about building not just my career, but my life. Because your career is in the context of your life. And that's why I hate the phrase work-life balance. They're not in opposition to each other. They are in the context of each other. And you are always thinking about what are the pieces of my day for each season of life. And part of that is going to be work. And part of that is going to be family and friends and community and health and rest and hobbies and whatever else. And so when I got to business school the first time around and I learned about portfolio theory, and how we think about our financial portfolio, how we can allocate our assets and really design an allocation to hit a certain risk and reward profile, and that we could think about that diversification strategy to mitigate some of the things that we don't control in the world. I was like, that is genius. And why are we not using it anywhere else? Like, why can't I diversify, I don't know, my brunch order? And why can't I think about this in terms of my career? And it made sense because that literally was what I'd been doing my whole life. I've never had just one job. I've never been in just one industry. And one of the most powerful things about that is that when these disruptions happen, I'm never caught flat-footed. I can make these pivots. I can reassess and rebalance. And so it's a model that allows anyone to think about how are you designing your portfolio for this season of your life? It gives you a place to start from that identity piece. This is why I'm so insistent that I don't introduce myself with just my job title. an identity that is separate from how you are currently monetizing your time.
Yes.
Because if your identity is your job, it can be taken away from you. So finding your identity beyond just your current title and seeing that expanse, that Venn diagram of what you bring to the table, because that opens up optionality. That you have as many options going forward as you did when you were in high school trying to decide what to major in. You just can't see them all if you have a very limited view of who you are and what you are allowed to do. So you have an expansive identity that gives you optionality, and that optionality allows you to diversify. And I don't just mean like seven side hustles. I'm anti-hustle. I do not want you to monetize every minute of your day, but that diversification can be volunteer work. It can be hobbies. It can be how you invest in your friendships and your network. So that if and when something falls apart, it's not just that you have other sources of income, it's that you have other things you can lean on and go in that direction. And I give tons of case studies in the book. There's research if you're swayed by academia. There are case studies if you prefer to hear other people's stories. And there's tons of my personal experience, because as Aliza said, I basically wrote this to explain what I've been up to. The good news is my mom finally gets it. So that's exciting.
Well, you know, there we are with the mothers again. But Sarah, let's talk a little bit about time management, because mm-hmm. I do think that for people that, you know, can barely get done in the day of the one thing that they're supposed to do, like obviously yeah. diversification is career insurance, basically, right? Yep. So it's personal branding, right? But how do you personally carve out your time to be able to support the diversity?
Yeah, no, this is huge. And I will admit, I straight up decline to use the phrase, well, Beyonce also has 24 hours in her day. She does not. She does not. She has like an entire team. She has thousands of hours in her day. I do not. And you probably don't either. So at the phase of life I am in, I have a one-year-old and a three-year-old. I have a husband who runs a town here in Massachusetts. We have a lot going on. So the phase of life I'm in, I have very limited time. I have maybe at best 12 hours a day that have not been allocated to my family, to sleep, to personal hygiene. And I have to do everything in those 12 hours. And what I mean by everything is literally, I will put on my calendar my workouts. I put on my calendar when I'm going for a head clearing walk. Now, you might say that's a little insane. You could be right, but this is
I do the same thing. I do the same thing. I love your reflection back at me. I love it.
Yes, I have to put it on my calendar to make that practice of protecting that space. And also I put it on my calendar. I tend to calendar 2, 3, 4 weeks in advance. It helps me see like, hey, you've got a really tough week coming up. Before you burn out, do you want to rebalance some of that? Is there something you can reschedule, pull forward, push out? I see you haven't made any space for exercise. You know that that's going to be bad for you. How can we be proactive about reallocating that time? So for me, it's about saying, being very clear of what I need and what I'm going toward, what I want, like my wishes for this season, and then being very intentional about how I spend that time. And then I just say no to everything else. And that is the key. You have to say no. There are so many things that I love that right now are a no. And the no's are really easy when you practice them. You just say, thank you so much for thinking of me. I won't be able to participate.
With a little smile.
Period. End of sentence. Warmly, comma, Christina.
Yes. I love that. You know, Laura, earlier on, you mentioned your word. Your word, was it the word of the year? Was it
elevation? Yes.
Elevation is your word. Okay. So funny. So my word for 2023 was impact. Ooh. Because in 2022, I did so many things and I was like, what the hell did I even do? Like I didn't even have time for anything. Like, did anything even matter? So I did less in 2023 with things that have greater impact. Christina, is that something you think about? Like a theme?
Oh, yeah. You might laugh. My word for 2023 is sleep. I have an aforementioned.
You do have a one-year-old and a three-year-old.
Correct. Oh, and like part of me sleeping obviously is getting them to sleep, but sleep, I cannot believe that I survived my 20s with as little sleep as I gave myself. I am now almost 40 and sleep is my non-negotiable. I am a hot mess of a person, of a wife, of a mother, of a friend, if I am not rested. Like me burned out is not a good look. So my health and sleep, I back solve from my bedtime every day when I'm planning out my time. I'm like, well, I'm going to bed at 9:30. So how are we getting what we need to get done? And if the laundry doesn't get done, well, it'll happen tomorrow because I'm going to bed.
I love that. Laura, what time do you go to bed, Laura?
Oh, I'm usually in bed by 9, sometimes even earlier, but I get up very early. And no, I know Ruth Sternberg said, I'm sick of all of the books that say get up at 5 a.m. Like, I think the whole eat the frog first is bullshit, right? Like the frog's always going to get eaten. You're going to do your invoices. You're going to get the laundry done. Like it's going to happen. Are you finding time to do the stuff that only you can do, right? And so like, I know that I am the most creative that I am in the morning after I've, you know, I'm on a rowing team. So after I've rowed or after I've gone on a run and then I sit down and I work for 3 hours, that's when I do my writing. It's when I do my rehearsing for keynotes, because I know that that's when I'm creative. By like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I can barely form sentences. It doesn't work for me. But I used to do is I used to like do all the, let me pick your brain calls, like first thing Monday morning and just get them out of the way. Until one day somebody said to me, like, that is your best time. Like, why are you giving away your gold? And so I stole an idea from Neil Peshrika, who wrote the book, the Book of Awesome, You Are Awesome. Mm. And what he does is he has three creative blocks on his calendar every week. For him, it's also in the morning. For my friend Rahat Farfouche, they're in the afternoon. Like it all depends. Like if you're not a 5 a.m. club, maybe you're a 5 p.m. club. You don't want a miracle morning, have a miracle evening, like whatever works for you. And my assistant knows that if there are three blocks in that week, she can move the Monday to a Tuesday, but she can't move Monday to next week. So I always have three blocks every week, no matter what. And like the other things that people want, they push. The other thing I do, and there's actually a couple of people on this call who have taken me up on it, is I don't do meet and eats anymore. I don't go and meet people for a muffin and coffee because all that was given me was a muffin top and coffee jitters. So I meet and move. So I'll tell people, if you want to pick my brain, I am available any morning at 6 a.m. I might be on my rowing machine. I might be out on a run. I might be doing the Harvard Stadium. If you live in Boston, you can join me. If you don't want to move, you don't have to move. If you can't keep up like a conversation while we're exercising, don't worry, you're asking me for advice. So I'm going to do most of the talking. So it's fine. I can't keep up a conversation. But what that does is it means that anybody can talk to me anytime, like any morning that they need to. I don't lose my exercise, which is the thing that, by the way, helps me get better sleep. Mm-hmm. And I get rid of all the tire kickers, the ones that send out an email to 15 people, like I'm looking for informational interviews. And so it really allows me to sort of take back control over my calendar in a way where I can still give advice and I can do the thing that makes me feel really good, right? Like I want to give back. I want to help. So many people help me along the way, but I do it in a way that's protective over my time. But Christina, I had a question for you because-
Sure.
In my last book, Limitless, I talk about how we are handed this definition of success by somebody else, and then we pursue it and we pursue it and we pursue it and we get to the top and we're like, all right, the top of what? Like, why doesn't this feel better? It doesn't feel good for me. And I argue that every 7 to 10 years, we kind of have to reassess who we are and what matters to us to decide what success really means. As we're thinking about our portfolio and as we're thinking about the, you know, like if you're thinking about portfolio investments, as you mentioned, when you're younger, you want more risk. When you get older, you want less risk. Mm-hmm. How often do you advise people to do a sort of portfolio reassessment of where they spend their time, their energy, where their joy comes from? How often should we be doing that? And what's the way to sit down and sort of think that through?
Yeah. I mean, you're sort of very similar to mine. I think that like 7 year window seems to be consistent across a lot of folks that we go through these chapters or these seasons of our lives that tend to be between 7 and 10 years. For me, it was when I knew I was about to have my first child. And I knew that like the pace that I had been going for the last 10 years as an entrepreneur was not going to be consistent with what I was going to have available as a mother to young children. And that I needed to choose a different, literally a different business model for this season of my life to support myself, to support my ambitions, in order to be the type of mom that I wanted to be. And so that's literally what led me to leave behind entrepreneurship and go become a professor for a season. But I think one of the tools that I use, and I'll use this as my plug and go to portfoliolife.com/scorecard, I built a personal balanced scorecard. This is completely a like mock-up of what companies use balanced scorecards as their kind of, you know, annual KPIs. But I created this when I was in business school. I was inspired by Clay Christensen and How Will You Measure Your Life, to create this as a way to say for every year, I set my strategic priorities in my professional life, personal, financial, and health. I set specific targets that I want to hit within those strategic priorities. And those targets have metrics. They have like, you either hit them or you don't. There's a way to tell at the end of the year if you did this or not. And I give myself a score. I leave myself comments and I check in sort of halfway through the year. But at the very bottom of my scorecard, I have a little like checksum equivalent. For anyone who does financial models, you will know what this means. It's like where you check to make sure that your math lines up. And my checksum at the bottom is, are you happy? Yes or no? Because if I'm meeting all of my scorecard, but I'm unhappy, that means I have the wrong metrics. I'm measuring my life in the wrong way. And that tells me
for the reassessment.
It's time to reassess.
I love that. Yeah. I'm taking that quiz when we get off this call.
Amazing.
So fun.
That sounds like a great thing to end on, actually.
There we go.
Amazing. You guys, well, listen, we knew this was going to be a good idea. So again, Laura's book is Wonder Hell. Christina's book is The Portfolio Life. My book is On Brand. You can support all three of us and get all three books. And if you love it, please leave a review on Amazon. That's super, super important and helpful. And we really appreciate it. Thank you for everyone who came today. And if you're watching this later, feel free to reach out and share it. We'll get it up as soon as possible. Thank you guys so much. I'm so glad we made this happen.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Leave Your Mark. If you want more career advice or tips on personal branding, make sure to pick up a copy of my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception. Want to land your dream job or kill it in your career? Don't forget about my first book, Leave Your Mark. If you want me to speak at your company or at an offsite, or if you need consulting services, please go to alizalick.com. I would love to connect with you there and on social media. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.